and he was with his friends, and the first thing he did was shove me into one of his friends, and he threw his keys on the ground, and he said, pick those up, you're gonna drive me and my friends to a party so I can cheat on you. That's what he said. And I was like, and his friends were also kind of like afraid, which I look back in time, like, why did none of these people say anything to him? But maybe they were afraid of him too.
That is Gabriela Cruz describing a controlling and toxic relationship she endured for many years with her high school boyfriend. Now, if you're a Cleveland Guardians baseball fan, perhaps you're familiar with the Sports Gab, who does the in-game hosting at the ballpark, or maybe you've seen her work on the Big Play Network or on local TV station Channel 19. This former college track athlete at John Carroll University and Syracuse University suffered the abuse, the torment, alone. She was afraid to embarrass herself and or even thought that she deserved all the abuse she was taking. But Gab was able to extract herself from the situation, and she went on to establish Love Doesn't Shove, a nonprofit that teaches young people that violence simply does not win out, changes the mindset of young people. Our conversation begins when she is literally running herself into the ground while a track athlete at John Carroll University, and she's not quite sure why she's not performing so well. First of all, welcome, and it's great to have you. Always enjoyed the fact that you really hustle after everything that you've accomplished in your career, and you've got a lot of different talents. You came to college as a runner. You Yes. ran at John Carroll. Take mm-hmm. us back to those days and then how things moved from there.
Okay. After graduation of high school, I thought I kind of wanted to go far away, so I was looking at St. Louis. But I wasn't really great enough to run. I would have to walk on anyone's team.
Okay.
So my parents encouraged me to visit John Carroll. And I didn't really want to visit because it was too close. I'm like, I'm not going there. But to appease them, I visited. And, you know, they had such an amazing aura. I really was sold on the mission of the school and serving others. I knew that I kind of wanted my faith to still be a part of my education.
How strong was your faith growing up?
And I think I grew up with a strong faith. You know, it was always a part of what my family was woven into the family.
Sure.
And I knew that I wanted to carry that on. Gotcha. I just wanted to continue nurturing that side of me and paying it forward in my everyday life because faith is a huge part of everything I do. It gives me purpose. So after visiting JCU there, I was suckered into going there. You know, I was like, well, this is too great. So I did that. I ended up running. I did play basketball in high school, but I was feeling it out, and I was like, you know what, I'll just run full time and try to get better at running because if I do it year round, I'll you know,
improve my times. What kind of events did you run? Yeah.
And so I ran cross country, and then in track, I was really a utility person. I was 4.8 mile. Oh, so mid-distance.
Okay.
I would have loved to have gotten more time just doing the 400 or the 200. And they used me a little bit there in the beginning, and they were like, nah, we need you for these other events. I probably should have, now looking back, just been a heptathlete, but whatever.
Okay.
You know, because we would do all the relays and all the individual events that were about that mid-distance range. And, yeah, I really enjoyed it. But it's funny, my career, my undergraduate career, I guess I just didn't know about iron deficiency anemia. But I was really struggling. I just, like my freshman year, I was having a hard time. I kept getting slower and slower, but and I was working harder and harder. And I was like, man, maybe just running isn't for me.
Yeah.
But you know how running just keeps you coming back? It's like always unfinished business.
Amen.
Oh, I had a bad run. Well, now I need to go have a good run. And I don't know, you start to play games with yourself like, am I not tough? So I stuck with it. And to my credit, I ended up having my high school coach reach out and tell me, hey, have you ever gotten an iron test? So I got an iron test, and I was completely anemic. Like, I had no iron carrying oxygen anywhere.
Wow, so, that's crazy.
So I here I am a freshman and I start to take iron and I think that I'm out of the danger zone. I've learned way more than I need to about ferritin. I thought I was out of the danger zone because I, instead of a 7, I got a 12 in my ferritin. For a range, now I know that I need to be at 90.
Okay.
70 to 90 to run at an elite level or like a competitive level, I guess. So, and that's not uncommon. If you go, once I ran at Syracuse later on, fast forward, the coaches wouldn't even let you practice if you weren't above like 50, or in that range. They just were already way ahead. They knew everything. So I was new. So I spent the next 3 years just struggling still with anemia, but then senior year, I ended up getting an IV of iron because, I went to my one doctor and I told him, hey, look, like they keep telling me I'm not anemic anymore because I'm above 10 of a ferritin, but I'm a distance athlete and I'm struggling and I just can't get it over this amount. Can you help me out? I got an IV of iron and believe it or not, I dropped like minutes off my time.
Barely, it can be that dramatic?
I barely accidentally, I almost want to say accidentally. It's not that I didn't put the work in, but literally once you get iron, I thought I had performance enhancing drugs. I dropped minutes.
Test this girl.
Every week I was dropping time. I snuck into qualifying for the national meet. And at the national meet, I was literally projected in like 180th place based on my time at regionals. But there was 2 weeks between the regional and the national race. And I just kept getting faster because the iron's kicking in. So I went out and I was like, shoot, this is my senior year. I got iron powers. I'm just going to put myself in position to be an All-American.
Oh, my God.
And I ran out and I did. So it was kind of like the coolest ending ever to my collegiate career. And then also me being like, dang, if only I figured that out in high school, maybe I wouldn't have had to pay for college. But yeah, that was my running career in a nutshell. And then fortunately for me, I ended up, well, maybe unfortunately, but fortunately, I ended up redshirting one of my track seasons because I was having a lot of IT band issues.
Okay.
So indoor-outdoor track, I redshirted. And because I ended up getting my master's at Syracuse the year after John Carroll, I was able to run there. And it was awesome. It was the best time ever. And I really have. I've grown an appreciation for learning. You think running is so easy. You just get out there, put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
It is, but it's a lot more. Like, the formulas for training are just... I learned a ton at Syracuse that I just never knew.
Splitting workouts or in reference are you talking about?
Yeah, well, I think it's philosophy. So, you know, in high school, I think it was very miles and time-based. You're going to run this number of miles in this time. And same with my undergraduate career. It was a lot about... Specific, like time this, time that, or you're nothing. Okay. I got to Syracuse, and this is a national championship program, and they were like, feeling. What are you feeling?
So it was the stopwatch and wasn't as much a deal per se.
It wasn't about so much. Okay, so we would have a couple workouts a week, and for those, you are fixated on time.
Obviously.
Like, hit
okay.
this here. Yeah. But the 80% of the rest of the time, it truly was about what they call time on feet. So just get out there, run for an hour every single day. And also listen to your body. If you're feeling bad, don't try to hit a sick
sure.
pace. Just go slow. My coach would say zombie shuffle if you have to. But if you're feeling good, then lean into that and have a good run.
And
I was like, wow, this is like kind of easier.
Yeah.
But it's takes you further, like it improves your fitness more. It was certainly tough because I was running more miles than I ever had, but they didn't really keep track of miles. Like, they were stuck on, did you get 60 or 65 miles in? It was like, no, did you run an hour every day, put a brick in that foundation every single day? He did tell me, our head coach, we don't really take off days, so we run every day. That was also mind-blowing. He said, we only do if you're sick or if you're injured. But if you feel terrible, just get out there and shuffle for an hour. Just get that
just
hour
get
in.
Just get the movement in.
Even if you got to cross train that hour, just get it in. And I was like, this is such a different philosophy than I've ever known. And I learned a ton from their coaching style. And it gives you a lot of grace, actually, but it really takes you further in the long run, pun intended, I guess. So.
Apparently so, yeah. You get as many miles as possible, per se. You really had a varied approach towards it. I mean, you go with the whole iron situation at John Carroll, kind of solve that right towards the end. But then because of your post-graduate work, you get a chance to run with a great program and see a different way to do things.
Oh, yeah. And I'm so privileged because I was teacher's pet. I was the kid who came walk on, and I was at the top of my game. So coach always said, he was like, if only you joined sooner, I could have got you a scholarship. That was the number one thing in my head. I was like, I missed out on a scholarship so many times. But even though I came at in a window where it wasn't possible, he loved me. I was teacher's pet because I would give everyone on scholarship a run for their money. And these girls were my best friends. Like, we all became friends, but it created a kind of a more, we all made each other better because you don't want to really get beat by a walk-on. But I was feeling amazing. I was doing my best, and they were training me, and it was just a really cool experience and atmosphere. Loved those coaches too. They were so great. I'm so fortunate for that experience. And yeah, I keep my love for running. I don't run as much.
Yeah.
You know that.
Yeah.
You and I are both, we're trying to get more miles in, huh?
Exactly. And the older I get, the more I just want to get out and enjoy myself. Kind of like, you know, the philosophy that you were feeling when you were at Syracuse.
Yes.
You know, just feel your body, feel comfortable, know when you can get out there. If you don't feel it today, just do something, but don't push yourself. And I think that kind of philosophy works for you no matter how long you go. And I've seen people in their 80s, 90s running,
mm-hmm.
and they certainly probably weren't adhering to, I've got to run so many miles today and it's got to be in this time. I think that would have taken all the fun out of the experience. You mm-hmm. just kind of got to go out and feel it and say, let's be active and enjoy life, and let's not sit there and count every specific meter that you run.
Yeah, I think if you have that habit, which all of us had to break out of, at least my collegiate undergraduate teammates, that habit of you got to check your watch and pace every 5 minutes, like, is my regular run pace fast enough? It does, over time, like you mentioned, kind of suck the fun out of it. It does emotionally kind of and mentally drain you. And sometimes, I loved at Syracuse, they were just like, don't worry about the pace.
Yeah.
For literally 4 or 5 days out of the week, just do the hour run.
Yeah.
I was like, that's so much easier on me.
Please, yeah, give me more of that, you know?
Right. And like you said, that probably translates even now. If we just move every day for a certain amount and get that movement in, it doesn't have to be your best day, but something is usually always better than nothing.
Yeah, it really is. I think I mentioned to you yesterday when we were running up at Penitentiary Glen, there was a study done by the Washington Post and then one of the universities about just get out, you know, every half hour, get up and do something for 5 minutes, you know, an easy stroll up and down the steps, whatever it might be, and you don't have to put in 2 hours of a run or lift weights insanely for it. Just as long as you keep that movement going, in the long run, probably much, much better for you.
Oh yeah, consistency.
All right, now let's jump a little bit from the running, if we can, to you're at John Carroll and you start a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen that often, where college students are saying, let's, you know, but yet, why did you, and tell our listeners exactly what it all means to you?
Sure. So the nonprofit is called Love Doesn't Shove, and what I've molded it into is mostly an educational program for mostly middle and high school students, to educate them about the dynamics of healthy relationships, equip them with healthy and effective communication tools that will prevent violence, or at least help you point out the warning signs of the dynamics that aren't going to serve you for a healthy relationship.
Okay.
A lot of this came from personal experience because my high school sweetheart, we dated in high school and into college, and it was a very ugly dynamic. And I kind of knew it was bad, but I was also just so, I was inexperienced, I was young, it was my first boyfriend, and I really cared about him, I really mm-hmm. loved him. So I was living sort of this double life with him. He was so charming and charismatic, and he was an athlete himself. So he sort of had this presence in public, that was one thing, and then sort of behind closed doors was a different story. So I was in this cycle for a few years, and it was just getting increasingly worse because he was not only a verbally, emotionally abusive person, but very physically hostile. So I think I spent a lot of time covering up for him or justifying for him, or I'd try to break up with him, but he wouldn't take no for an answer.
Or you probably thought maybe you were some of the cause of this.
Oh, yeah. That's a great point, because over time, he was always making me the problem. You know, you didn't call me back on time, or you wore a crop top that one time, or you... Well, someone complimented me on my mole, and it was his friend. He should be mad at his friend. Instead, he was mad at me. He got he got so irate because his friend complimented and said my mole was cute on my mouth. And I was like, so I knew as it progressed that it wasn't a good thing, but I was also just, what I came to find out much later is there's a lot of dopamine involved in a toxic cycle. A lot like an addict, because the highs are so high, and then when it's low, the lows are so low, and you're just starving for the breadcrumbs of the high, and you're holding out hope that they'll return to the person they were a week ago, or in the beginning of the relationship, or, you know, the person I see streaks of that's so kind and loving and I've made memories with. And it's hard to understand or make sense of the fact that you're in a unhealthy dynamic, because I think your brain gets washed with like these floods of dopamine when things are good, and then you're just so rock bottom is bad. And I think healthy is more about baseline. You got this wave. It's not mountains and valleys and mountains and valleys. It's kind of like
not sustainable.
Right thing. So yeah, we were running into trouble, and finally I think it came to a peak at school my sophomore year at Carroll. He wasn't a student there. He ended up trying to pursue his professional career in sports.
So he was from your hometown, though?
From my hometown.
And then he just kind of came to Carroll?
He would come. He would come unannounced. He would show up. He would ask people where I am, who's she with, blah, blah, blah. He was a master investigator, master manipulator, master liar, I came to find out later. I had no idea to the extent that I think he really... I can't tell lies like that because I can't keep up with them. So I was shocked. But it took so long for me to even get to that point of realizing, because I think when you're in the midst of it, you're in a lot of denial, and that's where I was for a while. Until my sophomore year, he got really irate one night. I had started omitting telling him if I was ever going to hang out with friends or do something fun, because he knew I was social, and I think he really didn't ever want anyone to talk to me or have a crush on me. Like he had rules. Don't talk to the senior when I was a freshman. Don't talk to the senior boys on your track team. And one time I was talking to all my teammates at a track meet, and
his teammates do.
Yes. He drove 3 hours, pulled me out of my track meet.
Oh my God.
And got in the face of the one senior guy. Oh, and then got in my face, pulled me out of the track meet, yelled at me, calling me names, blah, 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 because I broke the rule of I shouldn't be talking to him. So, and I still had 3 races that day, but this was a thing that started to become more and more normal. And my sophomore year, one night when he got super irate because I had not told him, I didn't tell him that I went to a party the night before. I started not telling him things because it always turned into this.
How taxing that had to be.
It was
for
so
you.
Emotionally draining. I couldn't do one thing. Or else he had a problem and he was so controlling. So he really made me feel like, oh, I'm a terrible person because I didn't tell him about that. He had found out from someone else. So his anger was off the rails that night. And I was feeling pretty threatened by him. So I started to just do what he was saying, because, you know, once you're in the presence of someone like that, because he comes, he will drive there, he will come to you, he's thrown rocks at the window. I would threaten him, you know, I'm going to call campus security. So then he'd leave, the campus security would show up, and then they'd leave because I'd be like, okay, he left. And then he'd come back. So he just found ways to always make sure he was with me and he could let me know he was angry.
This is crazy.
Yeah, so... Anyway, that night he ended up, I remember he was with his friends and he said, you better come out here right now, you're in big trouble, blah, blah, blah. And I was like kind of afraid, and I was like, I better figure that. I was so brainwashed. Like probably I was afraid to say no because he, like I mentioned, he just escalates. So I guess I thought in my survival mode, I was like, I better just do what he says.
Okay.
So I went out there and he was with his friends, and the first thing he did was shove me into one of his friends and he threw his keys on the ground. And he said, pick those up. I'm going to you're going to drive me and my friends to a party so I can cheat on you. That's what he said. And I was like, and his friends were also kind of like afraid, which I'm kind of, I look back in time, like, why did none of these people say anything to him? But maybe they were afraid of him too.
Had to be a ton of fear there, and they didn't have the spine to back you up, and you had to really feel isolated.
Yeah, I was just like, I don't know what to do. So in that scenario, I ended up driving them to the party. I asked one of his friends, I was like, do you think you could take him with you? Because I knew once we got there, we stayed in the driveway. He wanted to just stay with me, not go to the party, because he just wanted to get angry at me. And he was, you know, he was just being too physically hostile. And the whole way there, he was calling me names, blah, blah, blah. So I asked a friend in the back seat, I was like, can you take him with you to the party? I don't want to be around him. Like, I can't be with this. He's going off the walls. And I remember the friend kind of backing away, giving this gist of like, it's not really my problem. You guys handle it. So I was like, oh, man. And this was the first time I was like, this feels more dangerous than usual. So I was kind of driving back to school. And I was camped at a red light, and I just got out of the car. I'm like more afraid than normal. So I just kind of parked at a red light, or I wasn't parked, but I just got out of the car and started running down the street because I was like, I gotta go away from him. He must have driven back to my school or something, but my friends drove by and picked me up. They're like, what are you doing? I'm like, well, here's what's going on.
Wow.
I know you guys think he's all charming and all this stuff, but
this is the real
there's
deal.
Something going on.
Was there anyone you confided in?
No, like, I was ziplocked.
Okay. You were afraid that this word getting out would, you know,
I think I was.
People would think less of you.
I think I was, this is going to be the honest, most weirdest answer. I was in love with him. Like, you don't understand, but it's like.
And they say love is blind.
I was young. I was in love with him. I thought that this was going to, we had already talked about a future together. I don't know. I had this story in my head. Like, this was my high school sweetheart. We're going to get married and blah, blah, blah. We already mapped out our plans. So I think I was just in a lot of denial. I couldn't tell people how ugly he really was because I wanted to protect him and I wanted to protect our quote unquote future plans together. So, that night I just told my friends, I was like, I'm going to need you guys to help me out because I'm in a bad spot. He's bad. Like, I've seen him bad. He's put his hands on me before, but this, it feels like he's going to kill me or something.
Wow.
Anyway, he ended up in his fashion. He ended up coming back to school and getting irate in front of my friends. And that's when they really knew, all right, we're going to separate you guys. And I have great friends. To be fair, as soon as they knew, they didn't need any other information.
What could they do before they actually knew about it?
Yeah, I mean, 3 years I've dated this guy, never said a word. And I told them in 20 seconds and they were like, sure. Well, we're going to separate you guys. This isn't, the night's over. And, you know, they told my boyfriend you're going to stay upstairs with so-and-so. Gab, you can stay in, you know, my friend Taylor's room. She'll stay with her boyfriend, Evan. So we all separated. And it escalated because later that night at, you know, in the middle of the night, there was a knock at the door of the dorm that I was sleeping in.
Okay.
I kind of thought it was my friend Taylor because I was sleeping in her bed. We had all gotten rearranged. Or maybe it was an RA, I don't know. So I opened the door, and it was him.
Oh, no.
So it just got worse from there, because it was like no time elapsed. He was super aggressive and continued yelling at me and trying to choke me on and off, pulled me out of the room, ripping the jewelry off of me. Luckily, someone could overhear this, though, because this is in a dorm.
We will get back to Gab in just a second, but first, thank you very much for your continued support of Telich Talks, and I hope that you check out some of our recent episodes, such as how grief and insomnia and bad knees led one man to do the Camino de Santiago, a spiritual 500-plus-mile walk across the top of Spain, and how he achieved some spiritual balance, or why Dean Hall, despite dying from cancer, embarked on an amazing record-breaking swim in frigid 42-degree water, 187 miles, and why he is cancer-free. So if you can, hit that follow button, rate, and give us a big time review. All right, folks, let's get back to Gab. Love doesn't shove.
So luckily someone ended up calling the campus police and they showed up. So that, but then I couldn't ignore that. Then they're making us do the police reports. Then they're calling someone in from the Violence Prevention Center. Then they're telling me I might have to tell my parents about this. Like, and they're saying he can't come back here. He's going to have to get a restraining order. He has to be banned. I'm like, so it was kind of, it all came to this crescendo and I was going to have to tell my parents. So then I had to tell my family about this, and now that my friends knew, there was no going back on that. So everyone kind of very lovingly but sternly said, your safety is what matters the most, and we're not going to support it if you stay with him. And they kind of just laid it out. And so, yeah, like the act kind of had to give up. And I wasn't happy about it. I know that sounds crazy because he was frightening.
Sure.
But I was just, like I said, I was still in love with him, and I'm like, oh man, I was really gonna need some help to get out of that scenario. So the school ended up helping me, pointing me to the support group through the Domestic Violence and Child Advocacy Center. I went to that support group. It took me a year to do that. I didn't really do anything right away. I was like very confused. But because of the resources that support group gave me, it was so healing and I learned so much. Like, why would I?
How long of a period were you through them, working with them?
I went to them my whole senior year.
So the relationship kind of ended at the end of your third year?
End of my sophomore year. Junior year, it was a weird year for me. I didn't really get any help. My friends were kind of telling me, you know, you're not yourself. Like, I tried to quit the track team and stuff.
Okay.
And I was having, like, outbursts. Like, I wasn't
being
myself.
You're just out of sorts. You just were, yeah.
Yeah, my friends were like, you're not yourself. They're the greatest. My friends are the best people. They're my family now. But, you know, they told me straight up, you're not being yourself. You're being really defensive all the time. You're trying to quit the team. What's going on? Like, maybe you need some help. So it was a little delayed, but my senior year is when I ended up taking the school up on the offer, and I went to the support group. And it was extremely healing because it was educational, and it was the first time I was in an environment around people with very similar stories being coached, you know, saying, like, it wasn't your fault. It's not your fault. That was the first time that that really registered. It wasn't your fault that he behaved that way. That's his problem. You didn't cause that. So these little...
But you never heard this before because nobody knew.
Yeah, I was only hearing what he was telling me. Yeah. You know, if you wouldn't have done this, then I wouldn't have, you know, thrown your research paper out the window. Or if you wouldn't have gotten me so upset, I wouldn't have chucked your phone on the ground.
So, Gab, how did you go from being, you know, embroiled in this toxic relationship, you extract yourself from it, you get help, but all the while you're thinking about, I got to do something to help other people. I mean, it's kind of a conundrum to me, but yet you did navigate that. You went from you're in the middle of this thing, and now there's maybe a light at the end of the tunnel for you to get away from this, but now you're thinking about, let's start an organization that can help people.
Yeah, I guess that was the long way to say I created Love Doesn't Shove after I had gotten the help that I really needed, because I was like, that help was so healing and educational. I was like, we should really be talking about this. Not, you shouldn't have to go through that experience before you find out a lot of this information.
Yeah.
So I felt particularly, you know, I was through the support group, and I ended up switching my minor to sociology too. And I learned like about family violence, gender studies, human behavior. All that was so informative. And I'm thinking like, wow, I want to gift a lot of this education that I've learned through the support group. And even in sociology, I was like, we should, some of this should be things that we're telling students early, you know, just in case. And that was kind of the birth of Love Doesn't Shove. I told my roommate I wanted to do something just to raise money and donate it back to the Domestic Violence and Child Advocacy Center, because I really believed in what they were doing. They helped me. So we started as a little fun campaign on campus. We raised money. My teammates all got involved, and we donated it back to the DVCAC. And then after that, I felt like, what if I did my own thing, you know, make it more teen dating violence, not maybe domestic violence, which is maybe more mature, or people, I think legally speaking, domestic violence, you're married to the person. Okay. I was like, let's hit this young group because it's real and maybe that conversation needs to happen. So I told her do you like the name Love Doesn't Shove? I don't know. It rhymed.
It's and a great name.
Like,
good
she
job.
Was like, she was like, yeah, just do that. So I did that. And a couple years later, I filed for 501c3 status. And then I just started speaking. First, it was John Carroll that had me back to speak to classes. And then, I don't know, it just sort of branched out. I would talk one place, and then they told someone else that I talked, and it was went well. So then that place, that school would have me. And I don't know, just over time, it's grown, and I've been in a lot of different schools. And it's been really rewarding, because I feel that interactive conversation with students, and it resonates. It really resonates. And I hear stories, and I try to help them and point them to resources that could help them. And
what kind of stories do you hear?
You know, something that's crazy is it's not just women. And it's not to say it's crazy, because abuse goes both ways. But I think what's crazy is that men feel comfortable, boys, young teenage boys, feel comfortable enough to come up after a presentation with our social norms,
yeah,
and say that really resonated with me because of one of my family members, yeah, at home. And so I hear plenty of young girls and their stories, but I'm always struck by the number of young boys who end up sharing something with me. And
it's
then
very interesting.
And then I try to obviously help them, direct them to the school counselors, and just be a listening ear, because sometimes they just haven't told anyone, like me. You don't tell anyone. You just kind of think you sweep it under the rug, or you keep it at home,
yeah,
or whatever. You keep it private. And so it's those kind of things, interacting and connecting with students and feeling like it's really resonating, that keeps me going back and keeps me trudging forward and trying to spread that message and just that education.
Does the fact that our society now has so much of life being lived on the cell phone with social media, does that get in the way of your message to these young people, or are they more savvy because they might be, you know, have accessibility to things that will teach them these norms, as it were?
I do think there's a lot of information on TikTok, on Instagram. Like, you're right that they're becoming more aware based on the things that are floating out there on social media.
Gotcha.
So in that regard, social media is a big help. The downside I see, or where it adds to the conversation in the classroom, is how what we put on social media with our partner may not be the reality of what that relationship really looks like.
Sure, like if this were going on when you were in school, you and this guy could have been putting stuff that said,
I'm his profile picture, yeah, and he's talking about me, and blah, blah, and things are great, and we're doing great. And that wasn't the story. And, you know, it's crazy because there was a girl down in Florida, this was in the last 2 months, and her and I have connected now, but basically same deal. She's an athlete, he's a popular kid, but things were not well behind the scenes, even though, despite what social media was showing. And, you know, he attacked her and stabbed her, even tried to stab the mom.
Wow.
And now she's paralyzed from the chest down. And this was a bright, outgoing, and you look at those people and you're like, really, why would she stay with? Why? She was someone, she's such a good leader. She's,
yeah,
such a sociable person. How come she got kind of suckered into this? And the reality is, so many people are a part of a dynamic because they're unfamiliar, or maybe they came from a home where some of that was normal, so they didn't think that it was anything out of the norm. Oh, if someone calls me names, or and now it starts to spiral. But it's stories like those that really keep me pressing forward and realizing, okay, this is still an issue, and it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be that way. Let's give these students the tools, and even just violence prevention in general in schools, because there's tons of violence in schools across this country, and school shootings and things like that. And a lot of that is like, okay, we can't change anyone's home environment, but maybe we can educate. Education is one of the greatest forms of violence prevention, because now we can be more aware of the warning signs, how to really help someone, how to, you know, more effective ways to give people the tools to deal with their emotions rather than using violence to deal with them.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, this has been a cause that I'm super passionate about. And I just think that, you know, they've done studies. Harvard did a research study 70 years long, and they were trying to figure out the key to happiness. And what they found over looking at all this data over 70 years was that there was a big correlation. The quality of your relationships is really tied to the quality of your life. So another driving force for me is the fact that if we can just help people learn how to build healthy friendships and relationships in general, hopefully we're promoting more of a peaceful and happier society. And maybe that's too big of a goal, but I think that if there's anything little I can do right in the community, that's enough. I mean, it's a ripple effect. So anyway, yeah, very passionate about the cause.
Yeah, I can just see it on your face, and the times we've chatted when we've gone running or what have you, you've got so much passion towards this project. And I just didn't know so much personally, because I never really wanted to pry it out of you, as it were. But thank you for being so open and forthcoming, because it's not just me hearing this. It's people that will listen to the podcast, and I think it makes an impact. So I really commend you, really and truly commend you. And, you know, and always been keen on checking out how you're doing with your career. And you've done so many cool things. Most recently, you're with Big Play.
Yes.
How's that for a transition from what we were talking about? But mostly recently you were with Big Play, but of course, people, if they go to Guardians games, they certainly know you from the in-house fun and stuff that goes on there. Where did all that kind of come from? Because at least talking to you about the John Carroll experience in the Syracuse, I wasn't hearing you talking about the student TV or broadcasting anything.
Right.
Yeah, that kind of came after college.
Yeah, it was kind of a late add into what I wanted. Like, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was probably one of those people who could have benefited from either, I don't want to say not going to college at all, but maybe taking a break and finding out what I really wanted to pursue.
Sure.
Because they sort of just did this general route of communications at Carroll. And then I come graduation, I'm like, I don't know what to do with this. Like, what am I supposed to, what's going to really give me purpose? And I had a teacher say, you know, well, you're an athlete and you like to chat. Why don't you just put those together? I was like, that's easy enough. So I realized I needed more skills, though. I didn't know how to write for TV, shoot with a camera, edit, or anything. You know, do a package, do a stand-up.
Yep.
Didn't know anything about TV. So that's kind of why I did the one-year master's at Syracuse, learned all those skills. And it did. It helped me kind of really refine how to be a storyteller, or at least learn that process.
Yep.
And because of that, I was just like, well, I'll just see where this goes from here. I did know early on, I don't think I'm built for news. It's a little negative.
A little.
and people put on their news voice, John. Like, I can't do that. When they're like, what really happened on that Thursday? I'm like, I can't do that, guys.
It's funny you mentioned that, because three or four episodes ago, it's a little shout out to Natalie. I had Natalie Herbick from Fox 8 on, and she joked about that. She was at a TV station in Steubenville, and she had to kind of be more news, more measured, more not laid back, but just a reserved tone to her delivery. And then when she got to Fox 8 and was on New Day, she could be Natalie, you know.
Right.
So that's kind of the same analogy, right?
Right. And I didn't know, I was really struggling at first, because I'm like, does this mean I'm just being a stubborn millennial? Like, oh, I don't want to do something I don't want to do. When I spend all this money on school, like, I better go do it. So I gave it an honest try. Like,
sure.
Channel 19, I was doing like a 3 a.m. shift. I was telling people, I wasn't really jumping out of bed to be like, the traffic cones have moved, everyone. I know that you were so excited to hear me say this. I am running on no sleep, and I'm on the verge of tears. So I kind of ruled that out. I was like, can't do it. But I did get a chance to do just from chatting around. I got to do some high school football sideline reporting.
Yeah.
And they just needed someone so bad that I ended up getting to do like playoffs and stuff. And I was still getting comfortable on camera. So they tossed to me. There was one time, my first time, I was like, I forgot what I was saying.
It's happened to everybody.
They're
I'm
like, we'll
you.
Come back to you. I'm like, oh, crap.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, I was still getting comfortable on camera. And then there was an opening with the Guardians. They needed another host, so I auditioned. Ended up getting that. And in my first year.
What year was that? You've been there for quite a few years.
2016.
Wow, World Series. Talk about nice timing.
Yes.
Good job, Gabe.
Right. And it was crazy because, as I mentioned, I wasn't the most comfortable doing my job yet. And then we ended up getting thrust into a national spotlight. So, it was fun, but it was stressful. I was like, it's hard to think, and then sometimes, you know, people are talking to you in your ear, wrap it up. Yeah. Oh, hey, add this. Yeah. Okay, and then toss it to someone. I'm like, you're talking to me, and I'm trying to finish a thought, and there's a huge delay, so now I'm talking to myself, and you're talking to me.
Yeah.
So.
Or then when they're talking to you from the station, you're not hearing what someone sitting next to you is saying, and then you go on.
Right.
You know, and then you can now hear you say exactly what someone sitting next to you just said.
Exactly. And then the added bonus for me is, like, in a live environment, you got the drunk people just in your face and saying stuff and whatever.
People barking.
It was good. It really gave me some character that first year, just being a part of these wild crowds and stuff. It's just been such an enjoyable job. So I've kept it going every year. I've peeled back this season, just doing weekends so I can do some other work during the week. And do things with Big Play. The podcasting has been fun. It's been a thing, you know, we're just trying to adapt, and I was trying to pivot and be open to the idea of, with all this sports betting becoming legal in Ohio, there's a lot of sports books throwing money at different things. So I was kind of like, if I can hang on and be a part of Big Play and add value, I'm going to do it. And I have, and we've got a great crew there. I love everyone I work with. And they've pushed me out of my comfort zone too. I'm not a huge football person, and I got Football for Dummies immediately. And I've just been watching football, doing
cover to cover
football,
read,
trying to watch more and get the lingo. I'm like, I don't think I'll ever be able to be an X's and O's person, but I've really come to love football more.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how baseball was too, just being around it so often. I really came to love baseball and know it better. Just trying to keep being uncomfortable,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, just trying new stuff and trying to push the envelope, right?
Yes,
As best you can. I think that's really cool, too. And what's neat now about, I think, the media and the Big Play is a great example. There's so many different ways for young people or seasoned professionals to have their voices heard.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Play is a great example of that, you know, with our buddy Chris Reflog, as everybody knows him on social media, and Dave and folks connected with that network, as it were, you know, the Cribses and so on and so forth. Everybody's kind of coming at it from so many different ways, and that's cool. Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I was doing local TV as a 27-year-old here in Cleveland, there were just three options, and you only had the 6 and the 11.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. And then nowadays, there's so many ways that people can do, and people can make careers out of being just X's and O's.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to handle the X's and O's. And other people can be experts on other facets of sports. I think that's really cool. And you've gotten more and more comfortable just talking sports. What's that been like?
Yeah, I have gotten more and more comfortable talking sports. And I think it's been a lot of defeating my, what do you call it? Imposter syndrome. Because even when I got started, I just could tell.
You figured someone's going to show up pretty soon and say, all right,
some of the people I work with make comments. Like, I remember I shadowed someone at a local news station, and I shadowed because I didn't know how to work, like, ENPS, like those programs.
Yeah.
I didn't know anything. I was just getting out of Carroll.
The formats, all that stuff. Yep.
And it was right after I got back from Syracuse, but I was unfamiliar with whatever program they were using. And I remember asking a question to find something out, and he said, well, you can't be all beauty and no brains, Gab. And I was, you know, little comments, but it wasn't the first one. It wasn't the only comment. So I remember early on, I had this little complex, like, I can't be a dumb blonde. I can't make any mistakes. So I was, like, really stressed, actually, that's why I was stressed at the Guardian or Cleveland Indians at the time when we went to the World Series. So I'm like, please don't be dumb.
A lot of people
please don't make a mistake.
Yeah.
So there were little comments like that in the beginning that sort of gave me, and I'm glad that they happened, because it really forced me to get on my game and then built me some character and how to squash that, the outside anything, and just focus on the task at hand and getting better and give myself grace. Like, nobody's perfect.
Nobody is.
So I'm never perfect. Once you start to give yourself grace, like, I don't have to be perfect, you end up having more fun. The crowd knows you're having more fun.
Yeah.
People watching know you're having more fun. So that's kind of been the evolution of learning how to talk sports and talk anything, really, is to lean into just being yourself. And that comes with time and reps.
Yep.
But there were some growing pains in the beginning, which I'm grateful for, like, especially throwing me into sideline reporting for football over a sport I literally don't know enough about. But but to ask questions, and I knew the gist. So
yeah.
it was good for me to really take notes and do my homework and do the best that I could. I'm glad I had those foundational moments to springboard me to do that. But yeah, everything is fun now, and I do plenty of freelance work. You know, people want me to host this or odd stuff. It's weird, like you were mentioning, in this digital age, you can get paid for doing, in my opinion, I will do the dumbest influencer stuff, like with Labatt. Not that it's dumb.
Is this mostly because of your Instagram, or is this for TikTok?
Yeah, what? Instagram. Mostly it was Instagram, but there were different partners I've had, the gaming sports, EA Sports, that would do the MLB.
Yeah.
And this stuff is awesome, and I love Labatt. Love these sponsors. Shout out. But it's crazy because you'll do something, in my opinion, more simple, and there were and you can get paid for that. When there was a point during COVID when I lost all my jobs, I was doing Good News with Gabriela Cruz, so I was putting all this time and effort into these stories, and I was editing, and it was taking me so much time, and then people would, like 30 people would view it, and you're like, oh my gosh, and then you just want me to post a picture with this beer, and that's going to be a paycheck? Like, I don't understand how this computes. But that's the age we live in. You just kind of lean into whatever is there.
It's like the incongruity of it all. You know, someone, let's say like the Emmys competition, someone can go out and do investigative work, and it's game changing and mind blowing, and it's fantastic, and it doesn't get nominated, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then someone can just do a bunch of things about people doing cartwheels on the lakefront, and that gets nominated. So you kind of have to square yourself that don't be part of the problem, be part of the solution. Be a judge or whatever.
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. But, you know, I'll tag on those as well, since I bounce around with all my gigs. And everyone's always like, well, when are you going to get a full-time job? I'm like, I don't know. At this rate, it's not looking too, what do you call it?
Well, what would that full-time job be? Or even going 5 years in the future, what are you thinking? In your head.
If I had a full-time job, it probably would have been what I was doing during COVID.
Okay.
Since I had nothing to do, I just started partnering with people, telling positive stories, you know, cool stories. That's what I would do full-time. Because I still enjoy storytelling, and I like Good News storytelling. But now that I've got my plate kind of full, it's like I have to figure out, I don't know that I'd be able to really venture and do that. Unless Big Play 2024, you know, my bosses have given me the green light to do my own thing. I want to flesh it out, and maybe I go forth and do that.
Okay. Well, I think you got a lot of options. You got a lot of talent, and then again, you said tell stories. You do that when you go to schools and when you go to campuses and stuff, to tell your story that's really impacting people, making a positive out of what was obviously an amazingly negative situation for you, which has been replicated across the country of so many other like situations that are going on that people have no idea that are even happening, much like your own story. So Gabby, I give you a lot of credit. And I can't thank you enough for sitting down with me. We'll
thank
go
you.
Running again, get
thank
the dogs
you, Ryan,
running.
To my running partner and the pioneer of great storytelling and good news stories, because I think it's really cool what you're doing with your podcast. So keep it up. I like to be a listener and tune in to all of your stories.
Perfect way to end. Thanks, Gab.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Gab for a great conversation, and kudos to her for spreading the love. And don't forget, her organization, Love Doesn't Shove. Next week on the pod, an interview with Sean Spencer, who is the head basketball coach at Rhodes High School in the city of Cleveland. There's tons of challenges working with young people in the city of Cleveland, in a lot of big-time cities, and we'll explore how he has been successful and how he helps get kids on the right path in life. And after that, an interview with Robert Pope of the UK, a man who so audaciously thought that he could replicate all of the runs that Tom Hanks as Forrest Gump did in the movie Forrest Gump. I think it entails more than 4,000 miles of running, and he did it and looked like Forrest Gump throughout the whole process. That's coming up. It's in the can, as they say, in our business. And I look forward to you joining me the next time around on another edition of Telich Talks. Thanks for listening.